Vincenzo Bellini wrote to the librettist of his opera, I Puritani, "Engrave on your mind in indelible letters. In opera, it is the singing that moves to tears, that arouses terror, that inspires death." Most of the Bellini operas are romantic tragedies, but no one dies in I Puritani. It actually has a happy ending. Still, like his other operas, this one is about great singing above all. Bellini understood how to allow a voice to bloom. His vocal lines exude unique beauty, grace, and elegance. They're memorably combined with moments of dazzling virtuosity, and Bellini's incomparable gifts were never more evident than in his final opera, I Puritani. Hello, I'm Roger Pines, dramaturg at Lyric Opera of Chicago. In this commentary, you'll hear excerpts from an EMI Classics recording of Puritani that features soprano Montserrat Caballé, tenor Alfredo Kraus, baritone Matteo Manuguerra, bass Agostino Ferrin, and mezzo-soprano Julia Hamari, with the Ambrosian Opera Chorus and Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Riccardo Muti. Bellini was born in 1801 in Catania, Sicily. His father was an organist, so he was around music from the beginning and was something of a prodigy, already composing at age six. At the college where he studied in Naples, his output included his first opera, Adelson e Salvini, premiered by a student cast. Fortunately, in the audience was the most powerful figure in Italian opera at the time, Domenico Barbaia, manager of Naples Teatro San Carlo. He commissioned Bellini for his first professionally produced opera, Bianca e Gernando, which the San Carlo premiered in 1826. Bellini was a rather self-absorbed character and exceedingly ambitious. He knew La Scala in Milan was where he belonged. Barbaia was running that house as well, and he offered Bellini a contract for his first commission there. That opera was Il Pirata, premiered in 1827. Six other works followed in Italian houses over the next 7 years: La Straniera, Zaira, I Capuletti e Montecchi, La Sonnambula, Norma, and Beatrice di Tenda. Zaira and Beatrice were the only failures. Beatrice actually created an unfortunate rift between Bellini and his regular librettist, the brilliant Felice Romani, who'd been catastrophically late in submitting his text. Once he'd relocated to Paris, Bellini fit right into the elite of the city's musical and literary scene. When not indulging in suspicion and petty jealousies, Bellini could really turn on the charm. He was also irresistibly handsome, and he was able to make all sorts of important connections in Paris. In early 1834, he signed a contract for a new opera, working now with a novice librettist, Count Carlo Pepoli, a poet with no theatrical experience. Puritani was a commission from Paris's Théâtre Italien, where Gioacchino Rossini was acting as artistic director at the time. It was a hugely important venue, especially in the promotion of Italian music. Puritani hadn't even been premiered when Bellini heard that his rival, Gaetano Donizetti, was going to compose for the Italien the next year. Bellini, who felt considerable jealousy towards fellow composers, wrote an almost paranoiac letter to his uncle. "I had a fever for 3 days as I became aware of the plot actually being prepared against me. Rossini decided to have Donizetti commissioned also because in that way, set up against me, he would suffocate me, exterminate me, with the support of Rossini's colossal influence." Rehearsals began in December, and the new opera, I Puritani, was introduced at the Italien on January 24, 1835. Donizetti actually attended the premiere. Being invariably a humble, generous human being, he wrote to Felice Romani, "I don't deserve anything like the success of I Puritani." Within 2 months of the opera closing at the Italien, the four great singers who premiered it, and who had come to be known collectively as the Puritani Quartet, were singing it in London, where it created a sensation. The young Princess Victoria heard highlights from the opera presented for her at Kensington Palace. She adored it, and in the coming years, as a music-loving queen, she referred to it as our dear Puritani. Bellini was deep into planning new projects when he fell ill in September of 1835. He died shortly thereafter of a severe intestinal inflammation, just a few weeks before his 34th birthday. The plot of I Puritani is based on a play of 1828 called Tête Ronde et Cavalier, Roundheads and Cavaliers, by François Ancelot and Xavier Boniface Saint-Tine. They'd based their play on a novel from 12 years before by Sir Walter Scott called Old Mortality. Although Puritani has nothing to do with Scotland, nonetheless, early on, it was entitled I Puritani di Scozia, The Puritans of Scotland. The opera takes place in and around a fortress near Plymouth in the 1640s. The fortress is occupied by the so-called Roundheads, or Puritans, supporters of Parliament during the English Civil War. They were also known as Parliamentarians, and they fought against Charles I of England and his supporters, the Cavaliers, or Royalists, who claimed rule by absolute monarchy and the divine right of kings. The Puritan soldiers are awaiting an attack by the Royalists. They're raring to fight. When, to match the soldier's flashing blade, anger sparks within his breast, the Stuart camp will collapse in ashes. A brief prelude followed by a brief male or female chorus was a standard introduction for most bel canto operas. Bellini's chorus for the Puritan soldiers is notably vigorous and suitably militaristic in character, needing a particularly robust, full-bodied sound. Ricardo IV soon appears. He's officially betrothed to Elvira, daughter of Lord Walton, the fortress's Puritan governor. But Elvira is in love with Arturo Talbot, a royalist. Lord Walton is thinking of giving in to Elvira's wishes to marry Arturo. Ricardo is, of course, quite morose about this, as he sings in his aria. It's a cavatina, an aria emphasizing an easily flowing line and the ultimate in graceful phrasing. Ricardo's best friend, Bruno, urges him to devote his energy exclusively to leading the Puritans in battle. His men are calling to him. But he can't get Elvira out of his mind. He declares as much in his Cabaletta. This is a wonderful convention of bel canto opera, a second aria, but livelier in tempo, and sometimes, although not in this case, more elaborate vocally than the cavatina. The first Ricardo was Antonio Tamburini, the only superstar baritone of the bel canto era. His voice was apparently flawless, extremely beautiful, totally even, wide-ranging, and flexible. He was good-looking and a fine actor. We can easily imagine how gloriously he portrayed Ricardo. In the next scene, we find Elvira in her apartment. There, she admits to her uncle Giorgio that she's distressed that her engagement to Riccardo has already been announced. The opening of their lengthy duet begins with her declaring that if she's dragged to the altar, she'll die of grief. She expresses this in flights of extravagant, florid singing, giving a clear indication that she's quite an emotional young woman. Giorgio calms Elvira down by saying that he and Arturo have convinced her father, Lord Walton, that Arturo should marry Elvira. Naturally, she's ecstatic, even more so when shouts from the soldiers are heard. Arturo is arriving. Elvira sings of her joy, supported by Giorgio, in a stupendously exciting, vigorous conclusion to their scene. So it's set. Arturo is to marry Elvira. He arrives at the fortress's hall of arms, bringing gifts for his bride. Before everyone in the fortress, he declares his devotion to Elvira, singing the loveliest music in his role, a long-lined legato aria, A te, o cara, to you, o dear one. It can be sculpted by the tenor as if he were working in the finest marble. The first Arturo, Giovanni Battista Rubini, was one of the greatest glories of the bel canto era. He wasn't glamorous, and he apparently had a not especially imposing stage presence, but he was vocally and musically incomparable. After achieving stardom singing Rossini, he moved easily into Bellini and created roles in four of his operas. By all accounts, in any part of Rubini's huge vocal range, he sang with unique beauty, elegance, and absolute effortlessness. There's a prisoner in the fortress, Queen Enriqueta, that is, Henrietta, the widow of Charles I. Arturo has been assigned the task of taking Enriqueta to London and to trial. He feels obligated to help her. Elvira is in a lively mood when she encounters Enriqueta. She's observed by both Arturo and Giorgio as she playfully throws her wedding veil over Enriqueta's head. This is an atypically carefree, even giddy moment for Elvira, emphasized by Bellini's brilliant decision to use the buoyant rhythms of a polonaise as the basis for her aria. Son vergine vezzosa in vesta di sposa. I'm a girl dressed as a bride.
Just
Grisi, the first Elvira, shared several roles with the heroine of our recording, Montserrat Caballé. Like Caballé, Grisi excelled in the most formidable bel canto roles, Rossini's Semiramide, Donizetti's Lucrezia Borgia and Anna Bolena, and Bellini's Norma. Grisi, apparently, could sing anything. She was one singer who truly had technique to burn. Many of her roles were on the light side. Clearly, she knew exactly how to produce a certain girlishness in her sound, which she would have needed for Elvira's Polonaise. So now Arturo thinks Queen Enriqueta should escape with him disguised as Elvira, that is, wearing the wedding veil. Ricardo notices that this is being planned. Once Arturo and the queen have managed to escape, out of sheer jealousy, Ricardo informs Elvira that her fiancé has eloped with another woman. In front of everyone in the fortress, Elvira goes mad. She imagines Arturo is there before her, and she begs him to follow her to the church where they can be married. The Act One finale starts with the forlorn Elvira singing the sweetest, quietest, most intimately scaled Bellini lines. The very rousing conclusion of the act finds everyone expressing their concern for Elvira and proclaiming that she'll have her vengeance, while she, in her madness, seems to see wicked phantoms all around her. Two takes us to the great hall of the fortress. The ladies and retainers hear from Giorgio that Elvira's madness continues and that she's calling for Arturo. This is perhaps the most affecting of all bel canto arias for bass. A buoyant quality is needed in the voice and an unending legato, along with a truly heartfelt style.
Tinto di fiori e col vetrin di solto, allor la cara vergine s'aggira e chiede a Laura, ai fior, com'è sto volto.
The first Giorgio, Luigi Lablache, was an Italian who excelled in serious and comic parts. He was quite a rotund man with a large, beautiful, agile voice and a tremendous stage personality. One can't imagine this aria testing him particularly, whether vocally or dramatically. He simply needed to appear imposingly dignified and sing gorgeous lines. Ricardo has just received an order from Cromwell. A search must begin immediately to find Arturo, and if he's found, he must be killed if he resists arrest. Suddenly, Giorgio and Ricardo are riveted by the voice of Elvira. She sings from offstage, "Bring me hope again, or let me die." And then she appears. Observed by Giorgio and Riccardo, she remembers hearing her beloved Arturo's voice. He called to her. He swore he'd be true to her. But then he fled from her. This is a touchstone scene, one against which all aspiring bel canto sopranos must measure themselves. It's a moment of such overwhelming melancholy that in performance it invariably brings tears to the eyes of many listeners. Yes, this is a mad scene, but it's more contained in character than the one Donizetti composed for the heroine of his Lucia di Lammermoor the same year as Puritani. Lucia also has no sense of her actual surroundings, whereas Elvira does. She believes that the two men before her are her father and Arturo, and she begs them to take her to the wedding festivities. Nothing that Giorgio or Riccardo can say or do helps her to recognize them. Now she thinks of Arturo again, and she begs him to return to her. She's sighing for him. "Darling," she sings, "come back to love." The sequence of descending scales is the toughest moment vocally, but also the most exhilarating moment anywhere in Elvira's music. And that was created, lest we forget, with the extraordinary technique of Giulia Grisi in mind. Giorgio tells Riccardo that if he doesn't do all he can to save Arturo's life, the ghosts of both Elvira and Arturo will haunt him forever. Having been reduced to tears, Riccardo now agrees. The two of them anticipate a battle between the Roundheads and the Cavaliers. "Let the words country, victory, and honor awaken terror in the enemy," sings Giorgio, and that leads into their call to arms. This is Suoni la tromba, sound the trumpet, the most totally rousing music in any Bellini opera. Along with Elvira's mad scene, it's by far the most popular number in this score, a moment that keeps audiences returning to the music of I Puritani over and over again. In Act 3, we're in a clearing near the forest surrounding the fortress, the spot where Arturo first met Elvira. Now he's fleeing for his life. He hears Elvira's voice in the distance, singing a sad song that he repeats. "Beside a fountain, lone and sad, a troubadour sat and touched the strings of his harp." No one beats Bellini for combining melancholy with pure sweetness. Elvira appears, and of course, there's a joyous reunion. She asks Arturo how long it's been since he went away. 3 months, he replies. No, no, says Elvira sadly. It was 3 centuries of sighing and torment. 3 centuries of horror. This is a very simple vocal line, but a great singer can draw a flood of emotion from it. The final section of the duet is a declaration of Elvira and Arturo's ecstatic joy in loving each other. It's assertive music, and it communicates utter confidence. Arturo's enemies appear, capture him, and condemn him. He faces this nobly. In a brief aria, he declares that he can face heaven's anger if he can die with Elvira beside him. This is Arturo's toughest music, another glorious Bellini legato line, but sitting very high. For Rubini, the first Arturo, Bellini wrote the climax with an almost impossible F above high C. The vast majority of Arturos, including the wonderful Alfredo Kraus, make do with a high D flat. Giorgio and Riccardo receive a message that they announce to everyone. The Stuarts have been defeated, and all offenders have been pardoned. The opera ends joyfully, with Arturo and Elvira now united. Some critics have felt that the poetic romance of La Sonnambula suited Bellini better than the historical drama of Puritani. He was a huge admirer of Rossini's William Tell. He apparently saw it more than 30 times. Had he lived, no doubt he would have moved into a more dramatic, grander scale mode of writing, but it wasn't to be. Let's be grateful for what we have, a score that captivates the ear. As the composer Arrigo Boito said, Whoever doesn't love Bellini doesn't love music.
The music that you have heard is generously furnished by Warner Classics and is available for purchase on iTunes.